Now we've got in the studio with us our next guest. We've got Meg Slater, who's here from the NGV to talk about a show that's on there. Well, actually, I think it's on now.
It started already.
Yeah. Is Alexander Calder, our radical inventor. Welcome to the show, Meg.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. Now, we'd like to start off by getting a little bit of an idea of you and your background. So I suppose, and what we're normally, well, what I know I'm interested in is finding out how you got interested, how you got started in the arts. What did how did you get to where you are now?
Mm. Well, I actually started out, I'm from Queensland, so I moved here about a year and a half ago for this job. But I studied at the University of Queensland and I started out in law and very quickly figured out that that wasn't for me about a year later, but was studying art history at the same time. And just the contrast between the two, I was much better suited to art history.
Right. Were you interested in art during your school days?
Yeah, definitely. I studied visual art in high school as well. And I was very interested in the theoretical side of things.
Right.
So that kind of led me to art history at university because I wasn't very good at making art, could not do any of it.
Yeah.
I made a lot of conceptual works in high school. So
why did you decide to do law, thinking that was the safe thing to do?
Well, I have three sisters. Two of them did law.
Right.
And I kind of thought, I was a little unsure. I wanted to do arts, but I was like, I got a good score in my state. And I was kind of like, I should do.
In other words, she's really smart.
That's exactly right, David. Don't you forget it.
So I sort of thought, I should do law. Like, I should try something like that, you know. But I should have just stuck with the arts.
It's interesting that you had that you were interested in art history and art theory, but like you said, you didn't really sort of weren't interested in following up the practical side of things. But what about art theory and history took your fancy, I suppose, so to speak?
I'm always very interested in looking at art history within a much broader narrative, so understanding how things ended up being how they are now and how that's informed in everything that came before it. So I got really interested, and in high school you only learn like such small bite-sized pieces, and then with university when I looked into the art history degree I was like, oh well, I can start piecing it all together now.
But isn't it like this, when you look at an artist in history, the backstories are just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And you're like, you can learn so much from it, can't you?
Yeah, it makes you feel like your life is very boring a lot of the time.
Well, if you're interested enough in finding out about it, it makes your life interesting.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah.
So after I finished my degree, and during my degree at UQ in art history, I did a lot of internships, a lot of free work. I interned at institutions in Queensland. I did some internships overseas in London at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, cool. And the Brooklyn Museum in New York. And then I came to the NGV, and I'd done some internships at the NGV at uni as well.
Right.
So that really solidified it for me. I really grew to love the NGV while I was studying.
How can you compare? Well, let's try and compare Victoria and Albert and the Brooklyn.
Yeah.
How does the NGV hold up?
I mean, it's amazing. The caliber of shows, I think it's equally matched. I mean, very different though, because they all have very different mission statements. But I see a lot of similarities in particular between the V&A and the NGV in terms of, the NGV places a dual emphasis on design and visual art, and the Victoria and Albert Museum is an encyclopedic museum, but it also makes room for contemporary displays. So it's kind of...
And that's fairly new too, isn't it, the contemporary side?
Yeah, but it's great. You take something different from each place you go to, definitely.
Of course.
Yeah.
So what's it like working in an organisation like NGV, which is kicking so many goals right this very moment, isn't it?
It's really great. I work in the department that I'm in is a little bit of an anomaly within the larger curatorial department. It's relatively new. I work with my boss, Dr. Miranda Wallace, who's the senior curator in international, it's called International Exhibitions Projects.
Yep.
So unlike the other curators, Miranda and I don't have a lot of the collection responsibilities. We don't make acquisitions. We don't do collection displays. We do a large number of the shows that take place on the ground floor of NGV.
Are you working on next summer?
Yeah.
Oh, let's hold her down and tickle her to make her tell us.
It's an exciting one, yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah. I can't wait. Yeah. And we, of course, we're talking about Triennial.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I was going to say, I don't know if I can say. Has it been announced?
No. Oh, God.
I'm not working on Triennial. I thought you meant this coming summer, which is the one that I am working
on. But isn't it?
Which hasn't been announced.
Isn't it this summer, though, that it's.
Well, Triennial is. Oh, God.
It's biannual. So
Triennial's the end of next year. Yeah. End of next year.
Right,
it's triennial.
Right,
so every 3 years. Yeah.
Oh, 3 years, of course.
Yeah.
I thought it was, God, 3 years.
Just a year ahead of yourself, David.
Yeah.
Just step back a bit,
excited, David. Yeah. So, let's talk about this amazing artist and what a great backstory as well. Mm. Let's talk about him.
Yep. So, I mean, it's quite fantastic that we have a show of his works here. Amazingly, we've never had an exhibition of Alexander Calder in Australia, a retrospective show. And he has quite an incredible life, as I'm sure most of you are familiar. But he practiced for 60 years, from the age of 9, but formally from the 1920s through to till the end of his life. He died in 1976. And he is really well known as the man who made sculpture move. So he's really renowned for his invention of the mobile.
Yeah. Just that alone. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we take it for granted now. Yeah. And that this was the person that... Yeah. You know, like, thought of that and made it happen. Mm. You know, like, this is what makes art history so interesting, isn't it?
And it doesn't seem like such a radical gesture now, but no one was really doing that at the time. No one was taking the mass and weight out of sculpture and incorporating movement into it and sort of conveying his idea of movement through sculpture. But I think one thing that I've loved many aspects of working on this project, but I knew a lot about Calder's mobiles and I knew about his really big public works, but I wasn't so familiar with his beginnings, which is so interesting.
Come and tell us.
So he, in the show, it's kind of a nice way to tie in the show as well for me to talk through his life, but we have two incredibly early works to open the show called Duck and Dog, which he made when he was only 11.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he gave them to his parents as Christmas gifts.
And they still have them
in perfect condition. Whoa. You can see the pencil marks of where they're two cut from sheet metal, folded into place. One of them is kinetic, so it's arguably Calder's earliest kinetic sculpture, which is amazing. So from the age of 8, Calder had a designated part of the house where he that was his workshop.
Well, what about his parents? Tell us about them. Yeah. Were they wealthy? You know, like, to be able to
They were both artists, actually. Ah, so that was a lot of what fueled his fire. He was very supported in that way. So his mother was a painter, and his father was a sculptor who made a lot of really large scale works for world fairs and things like that. So he was very, very supported. I mean, the kid had a workshop from the age of 8, which not a lot of, he was working with metal and tools. Whoa. From 8. Yep. And there's a little self-portrait as well from that he drew of himself when he was 9 in the show. And it's him with all of his tools, wearing his tool belt. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
And then we go through his, some of his early assemblage works that were a part of one of his other major innovations, which was called the Cirque Calder, which he created in 1926 and performed mainly between 1926 and 1931 in Paris. But then, for friends and other audiences until 1962.
What do you mean performed it? What?
So it's quite interesting because Calder in a lot of ways really was a pioneer of performance art. He had the Cirque Calder was a miniature circus that he made. He became very inspired by the space of the circus when he was employed, when he was studying at an art school in New York called the Art Students League. In 1925, he started, I think it was 1925, early 1920s, he started to do illustrations for a publication called the National Police Gazette, and he'd do these impressions of performers at the circus, and through that he became very interested in it. And when he moved to Paris, another city known for its circuses, he made this Cirque Calder, which was this miniature circus. At the beginning it was just a few objects, and over time it grew to over 300 objects made from wire, found materials, that he was sort of the ringmaster at the back and would perform a whole circus act. It grew from 15 minutes to 2 hours that he would do for his friends and family, and then groups of the public as well. And now the larger Cirque Calder is in the Whitney Museum's collection in New York.
Wow.
Yeah. So that, for example, I was so amazed by. And we actually have a film by Jean Panlevé of the 45-minute performance of the circus by Calder, which is very rare. It's really great that that was captured. We have that in the show, which is wonderful.
Mm.
Yeah. And then some other aspects of his practice that people probably aren't as familiar with. I wasn't. He made a lot of jewellery. He made over 2,000 pieces of jewellery.
I had no idea.
In his life. Yep. All handcrafted, all unique pieces.
And for sale? Was he...
No.
They were just for...
He was approached by multiple very major jewellers to make additions, and he always said, no, these are just for my, you know, this is for me, these are my friends and family, for my friends and family. We have a beautiful work. My favourite piece of jewellery that we have on display is a belt buckle that he made, and it's sort of a woman lying horizontally across the belt buckle, and she has sort of coiled breasts, and it's almost like she's outlined with wire. And he made it for Teenie Matisse, who was married to Pierre Matisse, Henri Matisse's son.
Wow.
And he Pierre Matisse represented Calder in New York. He had his own gallery and represented Calder.
Right. So you said the wire coil on her breast. Jean-Paul Gaultier stole the idea from Madonna.
Calder was the original Gone Bra.
He stole a very strong word there,
Dave. He stole it. You're like, let's sue.
Repatriate.
But it's quite amazing because he actually made... he made that because Teenie was quite renowned for wearing blue jeans in Paris in the 30s, which was like, never happened, the American in Paris wearing blue jeans. So he made it so that she could wear, for her belt, that she'd wear with her blue jeans. So every item of jewellery was really considered and it had a special story behind it, which is what I love.
Yeah.
And then there's some household objects also. There's a toaster that he made, one of five that he made throughout his life. Looks like a sort of very complicated mousetrap.
Yeah.
But it really just demonstrates that this man who is, you know, very well known for certain kinds of art forms, made in every aspect of his life always, which is really inspiring.
So how big is the biggest mobile that you've got?
We have a really large mobile that would be about, well, the ceiling height in the space, I think, is about between 2.5 and 3 metres long, and it's called Jacaranda, and it was made by Calder after he made a few very influential visits to Brazil. Because I didn't know this, but the Jacaranda is actually native to Brazil.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was native to South Africa, but it's native to Brazil. So that one is huge, and it's really heavy gauge wire, much bigger forms. So in the 1940s and 50s, he really started scaling up and making even bigger works. So it's amazing to see the very sort of fine, delicate mobiles that he made at the beginning, which he continued to make as well, contrasted with his big public works and his big stabiles as well, his big public sculptures that are all around the world. One in Sydney.
Whereabouts in Sydney?
There's one he was commissioned by Harry Seidler.
Right.
Yeah, so it's out the front of Harry Seidler's Australia Square Tower. Yeah.
Okay, I know the one.
Yeah, it's called...
I didn't realise it was his.
Yeah, it's called Crossblades. Mm. And it was made in 19... we have a maquette from 1966, but the larger sculpture was made in 1967. But it's really special that we have the maquette, because when we asked, they have the original... Calder would make a small maquette, and then he'd make an intermediate maquette and then a larger one, because these were such big works and he wanted to make sure that they didn't fall over in the wind.
Yep.
But we have the small maquette that was actually in the studio in Roxbury until they took it out for our show, conserved it for us, and we have it here, which is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what sort of impact did he have on sculptors these days? Do you think it's there?
I mean, definitely. There's a very big connection between Calder's works and the way that they inhabit their environment. He sort of preceded the minimalists by several decades, and sort of works based on the audience's interaction with them and being aware, and the importance of spatial interaction as well, spatial and social interaction. So he's sort of, and then from the minimalists come the other movements. So he definitely informed future artists practicing today as well. Definitely.
Well, Calder was a little bit of a renegade
definitely.
Because he didn't like the hierarchy.
Yeah, he didn't at all.
The art world.
And that's, you know, that's really what informs the title of the show. The exhibition's curator, I should say, the guest curator, she's a professor at the University of Virginia. Her name is Elizabeth Hutton Turner, and she's a Calder expert. And she called it Radical Inventor for that reason. He rejected artistic hierarchies. He was able to sustain such a long career. He didn't belong to any one movement. He was constantly reinventing himself from the moment that he was 8 through to his death.
And because he's also a prolific artist.
Yeah, incredibly prolific.
22,000 works or
22,000, yeah, over 22,000 works and over 300, at the time of his death, over 300 monumental public sculptures across 5 continents. Yeah, really amazing artist. It's really rare and an incredible opportunity that we have the works here in Melbourne. Mm. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. When does it run to?
It runs until the 4th of August.
Right.
Yeah.
So we've got a bit of time to get there.
Yes.
But don't dilly-dally. Don't leave it to the last minute.
Go back a few times.
Yeah. I find that you need to, don't you, with an exhibition? You know, because there's lots of oohs and ahs the first time, and then you've got to go back in to really look and think about what you've seen.
Definitely. Yeah.
Thank you. So what's it called again?
It's called Alexander Calder, Radical Inventor.
Right, and of course it's at NGV International.
Yes, yes it is.
Meg, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Meg. You're here on Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine.